You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Lucy McCann.
Hello, welcome to LawPod UK. In this episode, we're going to be discussing extradition. This area of law has a fascinating history and is one that has recently been brought into the spotlight by the seemingly never-ending saga of Julian Assange. Joining me today to talk us through it is Ben Seifert from One Crown Office Row. Welcome, Ben.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. Now, let's start with the basics. What is extradition?
So it's always useful to have a definition, and there's one that comes from a famous case in the House of Lords called Pinochet. And the definition is a formal name given the process whereby one sovereign state, the requesting state, asks another sovereign state, the requested state, to return to the requesting state someone present in the requested state in order that he may be brought to trial on criminal charges in the requesting state. The process also applies where the defendant has escaped from lawful custody following conviction in the requesting state, or is otherwise unlawfully at large and is found in the requested state. So to put it very simply, Lucy, if someone has been accused or convicted of criminal offences in another country, then extradition is the process by which they are moved from one country, potentially the United Kingdom, to another country, which could be the United States or any other country in the world.
So is it fair to say that this area of law often gets confused with other areas, deportation and asylum law coming to mind first and foremost?
Absolutely, Lucy. So quite often people think that, and even judges sometimes, dare I say it, think that extradition is like deportation. But you could be a British citizen who's lived in this country all your life, who's potentially never even left the country, and yet you could be accused of a criminal offence in another country. And the process by which it is decided whether or not you should go to that country is called extradition. Obviously, a deportation would be if someone has committed a criminal offence in Britain and it is decided that they should be removed to the country of their citizenship, so another country. And asylum is obviously if someone is claiming asylum in this country for potentially political reasons in order to remain here, where they will be granted refugee status and they will have the protections of this country. So it's very different, although there are some overlaps because obviously all of these areas of law deal with human rights considerations.
And so I think we'll discuss that overlap a bit later on. But in terms of getting a feel for this area of law, I guess one of the key distinguishing features between extradition and immigration and asylum is that in extradition law, there's one key piece of statute that governs process and means by which you can challenge extradition. Is that right?
That's correct. So we have the Extradition Act 2003, which we still use. It was brought in 2003 after the United Kingdom had negotiated or was in the process of negotiating a treaty with the United States on extradition. But also it coincided with a framework decision of the European Union, which was the 2002 framework decision on the European arrest warrant. And that was a very important way in which it was said that extradition within the European Union, of which the United Kingdom was then a part, would mean that there would be swifter extradition. Indeed, in the Extradition Act, the word surrender is used as well as extradition. So surrender is the simplified process by which someone can be sent to another country. And so fortunately, we have this single act. And when you look at immigration and asylum, there are many acts that deal with those areas of law. But with extradition, we only really have to focus on that act
to my eyes, one characteristic of extradition law that seems quite unique is the procedure. So can you talk our listeners through the life of an extradition claim sort of from beginning to end?
Yes, of course. So I once had the benefit and the interesting experience of shadowing Metropolitan Police officers when they arrested an individual who was wanted on what was then a European arrest warrant.
Wow.
So I've actually seen a case from going into someone's room and watching them being arrested by a police officer to all the way until someone actually has been removed. And on the same trip, we had the benefit of going onto the plane, which was at Biggin Hill, which was carrying Polish prisoners off to Poland, because there was a time when there were so many people being extradited to Poland, they could charter a military plane, which came every 2 weeks. And on that plane, there were two officers per extraditee who carried the person, who took the person to Poland. So it starts with the arrest. A person, once they're arrested, is normally taken to a police station where they're checked over, and the custody sergeant has to be certain that the person they've arrested is the person who is wanted on the arrest warrant. And then they have to be taken to Westminster Magistrates Court. So wherever you're arrested in England and Wales, you are taken to one court in London. You could be arrested in Penrith and you're driven all the way down to London. You have to be produced before a district judge at that magistrate's court within essentially 24 hours, as soon as is reasonably practical. That's what the Act says. Then at that hearing, ordinarily an individual is represented or meets a duty solicitor who will go through the initial issues about whether or not the individual has been handed a copy of their arrest warrant as soon as they've been arrested, and they've had an opportunity to scrutinize what they're accused of or what they're convicted of. And then the solicitor or the barrister who potentially has been instructed to attend would have to go through these issues, work out if there are arguments against extradition, and also take instructions on whether or not the individual would have a reasonable chance of applying for bail. If you don't apply for bail, it may be that the judge will decide that you cannot have bail and you may be held on remand until you are extradited or until you may be discharged from the extradition proceedings.
Just pausing you there, Ben, are there any requesting states where a request would be automatically refused, for example, because there is an awareness of the lack of proper functioning judicial system, for example, or are all requests at least considered at an early stage?
So that's a very interesting question. Obviously, until very recently, we would extradite to Russia. But then obviously, after 2022, it's also notable that Russia has now come out of the Council of Europe. So we do not essentially extradite people to Russia. A request from outside the European Union has to be certified by the Home Secretary or one of her more junior ministers or even an official in the Home Office. And so in those circumstances, it's unlikely that such a request would be certified by the Home Secretary. So in essence, we do not extradite to Russia. We do not extradite to China. There used to be some requests from Ukraine, but obviously there were issues about Ukraine. There are some countries where there is a debate about whether someone can be extradited. And so I suppose the answer is, it's always possible. But if you really get down to the facts, there will be some countries where it simply won't be possible.
But essentially that discussion kicks in before a valid request is made.
It can do. Sometimes a judge might have a certified request and say, in all frankness, I cannot see extradition here going ahead.
Right.
And the judge might say, right, I'm going to release this individual on conditional bail or even on unconditional bail until a decision is made as to whether or not this is really going to happen. So there is an opportunity for a magistrate's court district judge to be very proactive and to encourage the parties to really establish whether or not it really is going to result in a successful extradition.
Can you tell me a bit more about bail and the considerations for bail that come at the end of that hearing?
So the judge has to decide whether there are reasonable grounds to find that if admitted to conditional bail, a requested person will abscond. And that's obviously the most pertinent issue in extradition. Obviously, the Bail Act is applied, and the Bail Act applies to normal criminal cases. And there are other potential arguments, such as a fear that an individual will commit further offences. Although, in my experience, it's very difficult to say that in an extradition context. So the question is really for the judge, is this person going to abscond?
Right.
And what the judge is looking for is significant ties to the jurisdiction. Does the person have a family? Do they do a job? Do they have some money that they can offer as a security for bail? All those things will reinforce and potentially allay any fears that they're going to abscond. And speaking from my experience, people very rarely abscond.
Interesting. Okay.
Although judges might want to remand people in custody, there are some cases where an individual has been remanded in custody for 18 months pending a resolution of their case. And after 18 months, eventually they are released. So if the judge decides to remand someone on conditional bail, they are released, but the prosecution has an opportunity to appeal the decision by the district judge to remand someone on bail. And that has to go to the High Court within 24 hours of the decision. So a High Court judge can review the decision. Conversely, if the district judge refuses bail, everybody gets a second bite of the cherry 7 days later.
Okay.
So you can then go and apply again 7 days later. You potentially could offer some more money, provide some more evidence of your ties to the community, and you could then be successful. After that, you can only apply for bail if you can demonstrate that there has been a change of circumstance. And then, furthermore, there is another opportunity to appeal to the High Court the decision to refuse bail.
Okay, so once the bail question has been resolved, either way,
yes,
we then obviously have a substantive hearing, and we'll go into some of the issues that might be discussed in that hearing.
Yes.
But let's say somebody is unsuccessful. Do they have a right of appeal? And can you talk me through what might happen at the tail end of a substantive hearing?
So if they're unsuccessful in their challenges to extradition, and I'll just tell you what happens in a European Union case. So a part one case, the district judge orders their extradition. If it's a non-European Union case, the district judge sends the case to the Secretary of State. And the Secretary of State used to have a lot of discretion as to whether or not an individual, after the judicial process, should have their extradition ordered. So the Secretary of State had more of a discretion. Now, she essentially doesn't really have discretion, and she is bound to order extradition. So after the order of extradition, in a part one case, an individual has 7 days in which they can lodge their application for permission to appeal. In a part two case, a non-European Union case, they have 2 weeks, 14 days. You put in your application for permission, and then your application is considered by a single judge on the papers, who can either grant permission for appeal or can refuse permission. If they refuse permission, you can go before the judge in an oral hearing and apply to get them to grant you permission to appeal. If you get permission, then you go to a substantive hearing and directions are set.
And where is your appeal heard?
So all appeals against a decision to order extradition are held in the High Court. Now, the constitution of the High Court may vary. So there are some cases which are more important in the sense that they may raise a more important point of law. And in those circumstances, it won't be heard by a single judge. The case will be heard by two judges, a divisional court, or even a divisional court of three judges, depending on the importance of the case.
And if they refuse your appeal, is that the end of the road?
If you fail to have permission to appeal when you try to renew before a single judge in the High Court, then that is the end of the road. If you have your appeal refused after a substantive appeal, then there is a right to apply to that court to certify a point of law of general public importance. and also for permission to appeal to the Supreme Court. So the Court of Appeal is not involved in extradition cases. So in those circumstances, you would apply to the court that's heard your case and refused your arguments and dismissed the appeal. You invite them to make a decision on a point of public law. And in reality, and this happens with many cases, they would potentially grant the certificate but refuse permission to the Supreme Court. In those circumstances, once you have a certificate, you then directly apply to the Supreme Court for permission to appeal.
Okay, so going back a few steps, you're representing a requested person.
Yes.
What kinds of arguments can you make to resist extradition?
So you can argue that the warrant or the particulars of the offending do not disclose an offence for which you could extradite. You could argue that they are unclear and they do not clearly disclose what precisely the individual has done. There is a lot of case law about how much information needs to be in a Part 1 warrant. And obviously, as I said before, the purpose of the framework decision and the 2003 Extradition Act was to simplify the process of extradition. And so they're not asking for a whole book about what has happened or even a transcript of criminal proceedings. They want it to be clearly set out precisely what someone is accused of doing or even what they're convicted of doing. So there are arguments about those issues. There are arguments about whether or not someone was deliberately absent from their trial or whether or not they would have a retrial if they were found not to be deliberately absent from their trial. And there are two recent cases from the Supreme Court on that. And then there are human rights arguments, which concern primarily prison conditions, a right to a private and family life under Article 8 of the European Convention. You may have arguments under Article 5 or Article 6 on unlawful detention or the basis upon which someone is going to be detained, because in an extradition context, it also goes into whether or not they have had a fair trial. Those issues are very difficult to argue. There is, again, a recent decision of the Supreme Court in a Romanian case about Popoviciu, when there was an extremely close relationship between one of the judges and the individual who was being extradited in a way that English lawyers would find quite extraordinary. And then you can also argue abuse of process. There are sometimes issues about, for example, a case in which I have currently been dealing, where the warrant itself says that there is a statute of limitations. And this case I've been dealing with says that the individual, the sentence for which they have been sought, expired on the 11th of July 2024. And so on its face, it's unclear how an individual could be extradited for something which is no longer a valid request, even though it is still submitted that they should be extradited. So there are some arguments about abuse of process, which we can also bring up. And then one more argument, which I should have mentioned, which comes later on after human rights considerations, is whether or not it would be unjust or oppressive to extradite on the basis of someone's mental or physical health.
Okay, so to summarize, there are various challenges that relate to the warrant itself, challenges that relate to the nature of the original trial, challenges that relate to the circumstances that exist, for instance, in the prison estate in the requesting state. And then there are a few other kind of add-ons. Do you think that's a fair summary?
I completely agree. That's very good, yes.
Thank you. So I wanted to pick up on this point about deliberate absence and retrial rights. And you said there were two recent Supreme Court decisions.
Yes.
Of Bertino and Mertacario.
Yes.
Can you talk me through those? They're both from the same time, aren't they?
They happen on consecutive days earlier on this year. And they essentially clarified the law on this very important issue. And so very briefly, I can give you a very brief summary of these two cases. They were both decided so that the decisions came out on the same day, on the 6th of March of this year. And in the case of Bertino, that decision basically said that the requesting authority has to demonstrate to the criminal standard that the requested person had unequivocally waived their right to be present at the trial. And this means that they would need to have actual knowledge that they could be convicted and tried in their absence, but there may be cases where their behavior is such that it established unequivocal waiver without establishing such knowledge. So I'll explain what actually that means. So you often get situations whereby people are arrested, taken before an examining magistrate. So we're talking about civil law jurisdictions. And they're made to sign a document, and then they are released. It's all very sudden. They sign a document. They're desperate to get released from a police station record, and they sign whatever is put in front of them. But what's important, and this is what Bertino said, is that what they understand is that when they sign the document or they agree to something, they have to show that by waiving their right to be present at trial, they did so in what the court describes as a knowing and intelligent way, so that the individual really understands that when they agree to various conditions or sign various documents, they actually understand that there could be a trial in their absence, and they are forfeiting their right to attend that trial. Now, that's quite a high threshold that has to be proven by the requesting state in any case like this. And it essentially has formed, or it essentially represents, a sea change in the way in which people argue these cases in both Westminster Magistrates Court and in the High Court, because there is now an opportunity to say that there are some people who really can be successful by demonstrating they had no idea that by signing a document, they would be forfeiting their right to have a full trial in which they would be represented. Then there's the case of Mertakariu, which talks about retrial rights. So even if, in the context of Bertino, the requesting authority is unable to demonstrate that you unequivocally waived your right to be present at trial, as long as you have a retrial, then you can still be extradited. And in Mertakariu, the Supreme Court said that you have to have an unequivocal right to a retrial if you were not deliberately absent from your trial. So it's not simply that you would be entitled to a rehearing or something which would be not as significant as a full retrial. And simply saying, which had previously been argued, that these countries respect the Article 6 of the European Convention rights to a fair trial, that it is assumed that you would have such a fair trial because these countries are convention countries, that is not sufficient. And Mertakariu was a Romanian case. A lot of these cases sadly do concern Romanian cases, where there was a concern that an individual would not receive a retrial. So that's a very brief outline of those two important cases.
I just wanted to go back to something you mentioned earlier, Ben, on human rights challenges. You referred to a range of matters like prison conditions, the mental and physical health of the requested person, their family life.
Yeah.
All of these things sound very familiar to someone who practices asylum law. Is there much of any difference to the way in which you'd run these arguments in an extradition context to if you would in an asylum appeal, for example?
I think the best example of this is the Article 8 balancing exercise. So there's a case called Selinsky, which is a leading case from Lord Chief Justice Thomas, or Lord Thomas, in which he talked about the balancing exercise. So when you're dealing with asylum, you're not dealing necessarily with criminal offending. So with Selinsky and the balancing exercise, you're balancing all the different considerations of that person's individual, private, and family life with the offending. So it's a specific criminal approach or extradition approach to Article 8. So for example, if you have an individual who is accused of stealing, and I'm not making this up because this does sometimes happen, an individual who is accused of stealing a bottle of Coke from a shop in 2006,
wow,
when they were 19, and they are now 37, living in Britain, working with children and a partner, and they haven't committed a criminal offence since, the question would be whether or not it is appropriate for them to be extradited for that offence. And that is why, as well as Article 8, in an accusation case, there is also a proportionality exercise.
Okay.
And in the criminal practice direction, there is a list of offences for which essentially the courts will not extradite. So very, very low value thefts.
Interesting.
The opposite of that would be you're someone who is accused of murder and you have a very established family life in this country. And in those circumstances, it would probably be the case that it would be more challenging to resist extradition because it's a very serious criminal offence.
And what role do assurances have in this context? So say a requesting state historically has been found to have, I don't know, poor prison conditions or there have been human rights abuses there, and now they're requesting someone and they're assuring the court that the system has changed or that conditions are better, for example. What role do those assurances play and how do the court approach those in the context of a human rights challenge?
So with Article 3 and prison conditions, there are some countries which now routinely have to provide an assurance that they will honour the Article 3 ECHR rights of an individual who is coming to their country. The first country that routinely had to provide an assurance was Romania after the case of Grecu many years ago. And so now Romania routinely, with any extradition request, will provide a document that says that the individual will have at least 3 meters squared. The document also talks about how much time they will have outside their cell and what opportunities they have to go into less stringent conditions for the rest of their sentence. So that's one country, Romania. There are other countries like Hungary also, which has to produce an assurance. There are sometimes cases where you get an indication from a requesting state about which prison someone's going to go to, just so that you know what conditions they're facing. You're then able to find out how overcrowded that particular prison may be. In Lithuania, we had a case which I did last year called Obonas, in which we submitted that there needed to be an assurance. And the court essentially said that there was no need to have an assurance. But we did this on the basis of an organization called the Committee for the Prevention of Torture, which is part of the Council of Europe. And they do visits to prisons in the European Union and also within Europe, Council of Europe countries. And they provide assessments about the conditions in those prisons. The reason why that case happened was because of a recent relatively damning report by the committee. And we argued that given that the committee had produced this report, it was clearly quite concerning that people were still being extradited to Lithuania. And after that case, the Lithuanian authorities, or during the currency of that case, the Lithuanian authorities provided information that said that they were dealing with the problem, which wasn't just to do with personal space, it was to do with inter-prisoner violence.
Interesting.
In some prisons in ex-Soviet Union states, they don't have small cells per person. Mm. They have dormitory-style cells, so maybe 30 individuals in a cell, which is obviously quite challenging. And they needed to provide assurances, obviously from Romania as well, that they would not throw huge numbers of generally men into these cells. So dealing with assurances, there's a famous authority from the Strasbourg court called Othman that deals with how you assess the quality of an assurance and whether or not what the requesting state provides can be given a proper hearing. Can you really trust what the requesting state says? And Othman provides some criteria which need to be addressed by the court. But generally, clearly, within a Council of Europe country, there won't be any issues about the assurance, even if you might want to argue this. The case of Othman concerns a person who was not requested in extradition context, but he was to be removed from this country. And he is a well-known person whose other name is Abu Qatada.
So finally on this point, Ben, let's say you make those arguments unsuccessfully. So you raise Article 3 in your extradition case, you're unsuccessful. Is there any avenue by which you can apply for asylum So you've gone through the whole process, the request is upheld, and then you apply for asylum on the basis of human rights conditions in the requesting state.
There's one other avenue, which we have not yet mentioned.
Okay. Go on.
So if you're completely unsuccessful, you fail in your application to the Supreme Court, you fail everywhere, you can always apply for Rule 39 relief from the Strasbourg Court, which is very difficult to get. And it's still a possibility. You have to show that the individual is at risk of immediate harm. And that's why it's very difficult in the context of a Council of Europe country to say if someone's going to a Council of Europe country that they should have Rule 39 relief. But it's not impossible.
So it's a bit like the sort of Article 2 real and immediate risk.
Yes.
Is it to harm, not just to life?
Yes, it's harm.
Okay.
So it's very difficult to demonstrate that when someone arrives in the requesting state, they're going to be subject to harm. And also, and this is what is always said, an individual will invariably have some right or opportunity to raise these human rights issues once they arrive in the requesting state.
Okay.
So there are possibilities. Now, in terms of asylum, it is possible to apply for asylum, but I would anticipate that if you've been unsuccessful with your arguments, the same judges are less likely to be particularly sympathetic to your argument
right.
on asylum.
Okay, so we're at the end of the road for our extradition claim, and I think that's a fitting point at which to end our discussion. Thank you so much for joining us today for your LawPod debut, Ben.
Thank you so much, Lucy, and see you next time.
Thank you.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Lucy McCann. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.